Hey everybody, this is Mark Ceffardini with Go See Talk. Thank you for joining the podcast. On today's episode, we're going to do things a little differently. In preparation of The Matrix Resurrections, we are going to go back to when we talked to composer Don Davis in 2019 for the 20th anniversary of that groundbreaking, genre-bending, mind-melting, kung-fu action original motion picture, The Matrix. You can almost hear the water phone and the triads and all those beautiful things that made the movie and the score so impacting. Anyway, I've been holding on to this interview for a couple years now. I used a large portion of it for a story I did with The Hollywood Reporter. I thought that you would enjoy hearing some of these stories from Mr. Davis personally, as we spoke for close to an hour and a half. So sit back, plug in, and enjoy this conversation with composer Don Davis.
Hello?
Hi, is this Mr. Davis? Hey, Mr. Davis. My name is Mark Ceffardini. Calling from The Hollywood Reporter about our interview today.
Yeah, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Are you related to Monica Ceffardini?
No, I'm not. I know that she's big into music, but no, there's no relation that I know of.
It's a bit of an unusual name.
Infinitely, yes. I've never met another Ceffardini that I'm not directly related to, but... from what I tell, there's actually a lot in the Kentucky and Ohio area, but no, I've never, because she worked, I believe Monica worked on Black Hawk Down and a number of other high-profile movies, but yeah, it is unusual, I'll give you that.
Yeah, no, I knew her when she worked at Columbia in the early 80s, Columbia TV music.
Gotcha. When's the last time you've spoken?
Had dinner with her and my then agent, who took her as a date. But she's very nice. Anyway, but you're not related, so
no
matter to you.
Would it would it make me cooler if I was?
I don't know about cooler, but you would know Monica.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Well, how's the new year treating you so far? Excellent. Not sure if you can believe everything you read on IMDb, but I see that there's some more scoring work coming back in your neighborhood.
Is only when I can't avoid it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've been doing The Matrix Live quite a bit. We're doing another one in Prague in March.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, what part of March?
March 11th.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's amazing how much film music is happening over in Europe. You know, I talked to Joe Kramer and Conrad Pope, who were in Baden, and then there's the, you know, Hollywood in Vienna that honors a composer every year with the Max Steiner Award. And I've been aware that you have been going around with The Matrix quite a bit, but what?
A lot of it happening here too.
I'm sorry.
There's a lot of that happening here too, not just Europe.
Yeah. That you're right. I met Michael Giacchino and I met James Newton Howard when they came through Dallas and they did their film works here. So it really is great. But I was just commenting that it's for whatever reason that Europe seems to be a bit of a draw as well. What number are you as far as concerts for The Matrix? Is that a number you have on the top of your head?
I think about 10 or 12.
Okay.
Yeah, we did, I have to look that up. Let me see. Because we just did one, last one we did was in Strasbourg. did one in Braunschweig and Stuttgart, Shanghai. That was good. We did a number of here too. San Francisco Symphony, Atlanta, places like that.
Yeah, I think you did one in Chattanooga and maybe Houston and.
Yes.
Okay.
Chattanooga, Houston, St. Louis. Where else? Well, it kind of runs together after a while.
Well, I don't know if if there's a way I can file a formal request, but I do a lot of work with the Dallas Symphony, helping writing and promoting when I can for them. So if there's a way to put Dallas on the radar, we would be humbled to have you bring everything that you've done for that series here. Fantastic orchestra.
That'd be great. Do you want to know who to contact about that?
Sure. From time to time, the Dallas Symphony with different Pops conductors does performances. If you have a contact, I can try to put some people together.
Okay, let's see. Why don't you give me your email address and I'll send that to you. Because it's a production company in Berlin.
Okay.
And they'd be happy to do it, of course. Okay. The money's right.
You know. There it is, yeah.
I'm conducting Dracula next in May in Krakow.
Coppola's Dracula?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. You'll figure about that one.
Yeah. That was, was that Basil Poledouris?
No, that was Vojislav Kilar.
It's been so long since I've seen that movie. Kind of a little too artsy in a way. I felt it was more like kind of exaggerated stage performance. But I mean, as far as visuals, you know, there's sometimes visuals stand out a lot more than the narrative or anything else, and that's kind of what sticks in people's minds, you know?
Yeah, well, with Coppola, it's never going to be an amateur thing, but
mm-hmm.
he kind of checked out when his son died. I don't blame him for that at all, really. He took it really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, and hasn't really done anything great since then. But he's still, you know, this force.
Oh, sure. As is a lot of directors from that sort of, that pack they all ran together, De Palma and Lucas and Scorsese. But
Spielberg,
you know,
was sort of part of that.
Yeah, I remember seeing him in some photos, and there was a really good documentary about De Palma that kind of chronicled, you know, how they all ran together and how they really helped influence each other's films as being another pair of eyes, and I think they all worked in kind of a collective, and not really a collective, but a good creative suggestions kind of happened between them.
Yeah, well, I know that Spielberg recommended John Williams to George Lucas in Star Wars.
That's right, yeah. I had heard about that.
That's no small thing.
I've had this conversation so many times. Movies like that and Back to the Future. The Matrix would be less than half of the of its parts without the score. And so, you know, when I talked to my editor at the Hollywood Reporter, I said, I'd like to pitch doing an anniversary interview with Don Davis. And he said, go for it. We'd like to get some Matrix on the site. So I guess thank you for being open to this. And if you're not Matrixed out, I guess from the sound of the concert that you're doing, I'd love to dive into this.
I have to tell you, you know, in doing these Matrix Lives, you know, and sitting there staring at the film over and over, I have to tell you that it's really, as far as film editing goes, it's perfection. I think a big part of that movie is owed to the editor.
Was that Zach Steigenberg? Steinberg?
Steinberg.
Steinberg.
Yeah. You might want to talk to him, too.
Well, I remember, if I remember right, he introduced you to the Wachowskis and got you involved with Bound. Are you still friends
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Yeah, I would be happy to. Because I think he did Ender's Game and the most recent Pacific Rim, if I'm not mistaken. So
he did do Pacific Rim. Ender's Game until they fired everybody. And when they throw out the director, they throw out the editor, too, usually. And the composer. It was Horner.
Oh, really?
And it was going to be Horner. And then they fired everybody and got somebody else. I forget who.
Well, I'll tell you what. Do you have a hard stop?
Oh, no.
Okay.
So well, what the hell?
Like we covered, you know, Zach introduced you to the Wachowskis. You know, I've seen Bound. I watched that in college, and you know, when I was in college, The Matrix came out, and you know, when they talk about life-changing experiences, it was just never seen anything like it. What I noticed in Bound over the years is how there were things that you like, maybe instruments, or you know, I know you like the brass section. The Matrix speaks really to that, but it seems like we wouldn't have The Matrix sound without Bound. Can you talk maybe about the correlation and, you know, certain, like the waterphone and, you know, things that you like about instrumentation that you brought to a big stage on The Matrix?
Well, I wouldn't say the waterphone was something that you know, was particular to Bound. But it had to do with what the Wachowskis resonated with. And one thing they liked a lot was the thing that we called pile driver. Which kind of started out as sort of a, I guess, a manipulated recording of an actual pile driver, you know, which is rhythmic. And so I had some samples and stuff that were just basically a big slam, and they love that kind of stuff. So that had a lot to do with what went into The Matrix, because I knew what they liked. And another thing that was really interesting about them is that they hated the gamelan, which I found really kind of bizarre, because I love gamelan. But anything kind of bell-like, you know, they would gong immediately. And that was true with Bound as well as Matrix.
And Bound had a lot of big jazz component to it, which ties back to your interests as a trumpet player. But I've heard you describe...
Which The Matrix did not, of course.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't inferring that was carried over, but I've heard you describe The Matrix as minimalist and postmodern. What I take from The Matrix is you've got huge brass section, string work is phenomenal. I have to say that you, Henry Jackman, and Patrick Doyle get the most out of any string section that I've heard, and I'd like to say I've listened to a lot of film music. But then you have the percussion, you know, the drums and the piano. So using the term minimalist, what was your goal? What did you not want, aside from the gamelan? What was not intended for The Matrix?
First of all, John Williams, I think, gets the cake for string writing, as does Randy Newman. What was the question? What do I mean by minimalist?
Yes, you described, I think it was the commentary on The Matrix. You said something to the effect that the score is minimalist and postmodern. So I'm curious how you maybe limited the amount of instruments or what that translates to as far as your selection of instruments and what you wrote for.
Well, it wasn't a matter of the limiting instruments. It was orchestral, so I had, you know, all of those. But what I was referring to is, you know, I had kept my hand in concert music as well. And at the time, there were a number of composers, American composers, who were kind of dominating the scene, and that would be John Adams, David Lang, Aaron Kernis, Michael Torkey, and composers like that. And there was kind of a language amongst them. I think to a lesser extent, Philip Glass and Steve Reich. But there's sort of a language amongst them that came out of minimalism, but I think postmodern is a better description because it's not really minimal in the way that the minimalist composers started out doing anyway. But it was just kind of a harmonic language mostly, and the use of repetition and things like that that I was referring to, and that I thought was a great opportunity in this movie because the narrative and the feel of it was really pretty unique, and I wanted to do something that I didn't think I had heard before in films, but I had heard I'd been doing it in concert stuff, but I'd heard in these other composers too.
To go back to the pile driver, there's a part towards the end of The Matrix where Neo and Trinity are walking into the office building. And now that you've told me that's a pile driver, it seems like you've timed the rhythm of Neo walking through the metal detector to a pile driver sound. So you've got the left footstep, the right footstep.
Right.
Is there
that was pretty much a directive from them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, is there a certain...
I mean, not that I was objecting to it, but they pretty much said, do a pile driver on a seat.
Okay, I gotcha. Well, is there a certain sequence or part of the story that you felt like that was your starting point or you wanted to base it on and then expand, or how did you...
Well, I'll tell you, there was one sequence, and it was a sequence I started with because they hadn't finished the main title, photography yet, or I guess the main title animation, if you will. And that's the scene where Trinity was running across the rooftops and the agents were pursuing her.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point she jumped across the street from one rooftop to another. And there was a shot above her looking down on the street. And when we spotted it, they said they wanted the huge, a big orchestral statement. So I wrote a big orchestral statement. And when they heard it, they go, oh, no, you got to hear the sirens. Because in that shot on the street, there were fire trucks and lights going off and stuff, which I didn't even notice. So I thought, okay, now what do I do? Because they want huge, big, something, action. But you got to hear the sirens.
Mm-hmm.
So what I came up with was that thing with the brass where it gets louder and softer, that thing. the brass, which is kind of a new music meme, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Going back to the 50s, in which dynamics are reduced to a parameter in themselves. So I did that, and they liked it. And when you do something that they like, you better do it again. So when I got the main title, I did that. And that kind of was something that I could go back to in those kind of moments where, Neo is doing something magical. And that became the thing that happened when in that bullet time shot that kind of made the movie.
I see.
On the rooftop.
Awesome.
Rooftop of the office building you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Where he bends over backwards, and that's
right.
The one that's used in, I can't imagine. I think it's incalculable how many times that's been referenced or, like you said, memed. So,
I mean, it's when something hits the zeitgeist, it's really a pretty exciting moment. And it's interesting about that, in that I noticed that the people who were over at the time, who were like over 60 or so, they'd see the movie and they just didn't get it. And I'm not quite sure why that was, because for younger people, it was right in the pocket. I think maybe if you'd never played a video game or something, you weren't quite, because stuff like, you know, when they'd kill Agent Smith and then he'd come back as somebody else, you know, they couldn't wrap their head around that, where it was pretty well explained in the exposition.
Yeah.
But I guess if you weren't at the time familiar with computer type stuff, and I guess the only computer animation at the time was video games.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't acclimated to the idea where something could be killed but then the program would come up somewhere else, you wouldn't get it. But I thought it was kind of interesting that older people just were like, "What the hell is that?"
You know? Yeah.
Which I think might have been part of its zeitgeist, in that it gave an aura of exclusivity to people who really understood it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, because you've got a culture that is, you know, raised on one thing. I guess maybe do people over 60s, what's probably the craziest movie they've maybe ever seen? Is Logan's Run, or, you know, would it be The Planet of the Apes? I can't really imagine more heady movies that could have prepared them for something like The Matrix.
Well, you would think that, what was that Ridley Scott movie? The Philip K. Dick book, what was that called?
Oh, Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. You'd think Blade Runner would have gotten them into it, but I don't know, I suppose those people didn't see that either.
Hmm.
I don't know, but I thought that was kind of interesting. A number of people, and they were all amongst my older friends, were just like, what?
Well, you know, you talk about, I'm not sure if you can explain this the way the Wachowskis would do it, but, you know, the movie ends where it begins. You know, Neo has a confrontation with Smith in the same room where Trinity fights off those officers.
Yeah.
And the whole movie's very cyclical. What kind of things did they tell you about the story and their philosophy that maybe changed the way you approach the music or... you know, the conversations you had to help develop this from meeting to meeting.
The Wachowskis weren't particularly communicative guys. Well, not guys anymore.
Yeah.
But they weren't particularly communicative people. So, and they seemed to have, since they seemed to know what each other was thinking, they seemed to have kind of an assumption that everybody else knew what they were thinking, too. So a lot of it was a guessing game. But I got a lot more input from Zach into what they were thinking than I got from them directly.
Mm, okay.
And actually, when they got back from Sydney with a rough cut, Zach and I sat down, went through a bunch of CDs and played them against the picture. And, that's when the postmodern thing really started to develop. And... So it wasn't so easy to get, like for example, when I said, they said they wanted, you know, huge action, you know, when Trinity jumped across the street, but then when they saw it, that's exactly what they didn't want.
Hmm, gotcha.
There's a lot of that kind of thing going on with most directors, actually, but it wasn't so easy to get a concept from them specifically about me.
Okay.
But they were certainly big on word games and number games and cyclical ideas, like you say,
mm-hmm.
and things returning to their source. And, you know, the dialogue was really very interesting because, I don't know, maybe the dialogue was sort of the way they talk, because, you know... things that seemingly didn't mean anything meant something. Like when the Oracle told Neo that he wasn't the one. She didn't say he wasn't the one. You know, it was very cleverly
uh-huh.
put out. You know, she says, and then I say, mm-hmm, and you say, what? and then you say, he says, I'm not the one.
Mm-hmm.
She says, sorry, kid.
Yeah.
You got the gift, but it looks like you're waiting for something. He goes, what? I don't know, another life maybe. Well, the other life meant that once Smith killed him and he came back to life like Jesus, then he'd be the one.
Mm-hmm.
She never said, you're not the one. She said, you're waiting to die. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So that kind of cryptic stuff was really what attracted me to the movie more than the special effects and the kung fu and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the scene toward the beginning when the guy comes to Neo's door and he wants to buy an illegal program. You know, and he gives him the money and Neo goes in and opens a book that's hollowed out and puts the money in and takes the program out.
Mm-hmm.
The book is called Simulacra and Simulation by Jean Baudrillard. And when you open the book through the hollowed out on the other side, chapters on nihilism.
Nihilism, yeah, I noticed that.
And then, so he hands the guy the program. The guy says, you're my savior, man. You're my personal Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Neo says, she got caught with that. He goes, I know, you don't exist. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that really hooked me into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, the cyclical nature of it was very, very well thought out.
Yeah. And even something sort of throwaway, like when Switch calls him Copper Top, and then you don't really figure
right.
out why, is like until, oh, he's a battery later on. So the humans are batteries. It's so dense, so amazing. And
yeah, Copper Top, that was a good one. And she, that character originally, it changed later on, but originally she was, her name was Switch, and she was a woman in Zion and on the ship, but when she went to the Matrix, she became a man.
Interesting. Okay.
That's why she's called Switch. So they softened that and just made her kind of androgynous.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I don't know, maybe they should have left that in. That was a pretty good narrative.
Yeah.
And was consistent with the, you know, when you go into the Matrix, you have this, something self-image, you know.
Residual self-image? Yeah, residual self-image.
Yeah, that's what Morpheus says.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, of course, all the religious references, like, you know, Morpheus is the god of dreams, and the Nebuchadnezzar was a king in the Bible who had a dream that he had Daniel interpret, you know, stuff like that. And Trinity, of course.
Yeah, the Trinity.
and Neo was clearly a Jesus figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he died for our sins, comes back, and, you know, performs a few miracles, dies for our sins, comes back, goes up into heaven. Literally at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
I personally thought Zion was a little too on the nose. They could have backed off on that one a little. But who am I?
Yeah.
There's also, you know, there's also a big subtext that wasn't lost on me, but that the whole movies are a simulacra, you know, and the audience is looking at this movie, you know, it's kind of like when Smith says, have you ever looked at them, all these people, you know, just unaware? It was, you know, the whole idea of it was, the whole idea of movies is what they were sort of spoofing in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say, you know, did they discuss with me stuff? They didn't really. And at one point I said to them, you know, Neo isn't the one. They go, huh? I said, he's the Eon. And Andy said, it's amazing how many people don't get that. You know, because Neo One and Eon are anagrams.
Talking up that, you've got two tracks on, or one track at least, on The Matrix. It's Exit Mr. Hat. So you got to have some fun with this as well. What were some of the things that, you know, whose decision was it, and, you know, how much control did you have, and, you know, was there more things that you wanted to wordplay and contribute to this world?
Well, in terms of titling the cues, you know, that's, you know, nobody tells me what to do. I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I get too obscene and then somebody in France complains or something. But, yeah, the Wachowski brothers yielded some pretty good anagrams, including Bow Whisk Orchestra and Switch or Break Show.
On the in the subway fight with Neo, with Neo and Smith at the end, on the commentary, you said you wanted to take it was a distillation down to the fundamentals of rhythm and dynamics. And as an orchestrator who has control over all the different pieces that you write for instrument, for the different players, what does that mean to somebody like myself? How do you distill down to fundamentals?
Well, let's see. Explain this. Well, you know, music can be broken down into melody, harmony, and rhythm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you separate those three things, you can have a melody, you know, just which is just a you know, one note or one finger piano line, let's say. Harmony is just the chords without the melody, and rhythm is just rhythm, you know. So breaking these down to the fundamentals means you concentrate on one of those parameters. And like I said before, I think what I was referring to more was the parameter of dynamics, you know, which is what is loud or soft. Or it starts soft and gets loud, or starts loud and gets soft. But if it's just that, you just have a chord going, then you're distilling it to a more fundamental property.
I see.
You see what I mean?
Is that kind of like the very first notes in the title?
Yeah.
Okay.
The very first notes in the title. Wait a minute. No. What do you mean by the first notes of the title?
Oh, when the Village Road Show and the Warner Brothers is starting, and it's that wah, wah, and then the water phone starts. So, is
yeah. There's some stuff before that, but then those seesawing chords come in.
Okay.
But I think specifically in that in the subway fight, I think the gist of it was you know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of just rhythm.
Okay, I see.
And
that was all done with the brass. Trombones and trumpets, maybe? Or French horns?
French horns, yeah. It's definitely brass oriented.
Okay.
And percussion, but so, and that's kind of it's kind of a 20th century, you know, 21st century music paradigm where you, you know, after World War II, when music really went crazy because, you know, there was so much brutality in the war that composers in Darmstadt felt that they should. They needed to reinvent the whole thing, and which meant stripping down to the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard it said, to be original, you have to go back to the origin. And that's kind of what they were doing. So that's kind of what I was talking about.
I gotcha. Well, is, you know, I know the if you look at the lifespan of the Matrix, because you have the Matrix and then the Animatrix and then the sequels and then the video games, and, you know, they were trying to tell this story across so many mediums, which is really groundbreaking if you think about it. And the fact that the studio allowed them to do that. And the interesting thing is you got parts of the story by, you know, you had to kind of, to get the whole story, you had to do everything, which is a little bit exhausting. But still, you know, you play the video game and you find pieces that Nairobi and Cypher, you know, the little jaunts that they went on. So is the contributions you made to the Animatrix, was there an idea, and then the sequels, was there an idea to really tarp over the whole series? Because I know that the music developed as the sequels went on, but how do you maintain the core of something, but then sort of develop it and expand it as the story progresses?
Well, I think it's pretty true that in situations like that, when you try to expand kind of infinite, in an infinite way, you ultimately lose control of it. And with the Wachowskis, like the anime, they had a number of other directors doing those animes, and those people had their own ideas. And so it seemed to me that things kind of got diluted as it went down, and as there's more stuff than any of us could really keep a control over. And then you had, the studio to contend with.
Gotcha.
So it wasn't as cohesive as I would have liked it. You know, and the anime is, you know, I was dealing with a different director every time. And so that became difficult.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of keeping the continuity. Plus, I had to do it on synthesizers. That's pretty limiting too, especially back then.
Gotcha. There was Detective Story, and then there was
right.
The First Renaissance, and then there was Kid's Story, and they all kind of, you know, they had to, you know, I believe Peter Lung was one of the directors, and like you said, they have their own agendas and thoughts, but. But I guess that would be no different than maybe, what, scoring TV or anything that is, you know, outside of a 90, 120-minute narrative?
Sure. I mean, or if you look at something like Star Trek or Mission Impossible,
mm-hmm.
that started out as TV shows and then went through many other iterations, and that the, you know, the new Mission Impossibles don't bear much relationship to the original TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine, I suppose. But it's, you know, in terms of keeping the continuity of an idea, it becomes difficult. I think the only way you can really do that is if you write books. And if you look at George Martin's books,
mm-hmm.
you know, that have become a TV series. But in becoming a TV series, a lot of the ideas became splintered. I think is the best way to put it. But in terms of those seven books, five of which have been written already, he keeps a really remarkable continuity of idea. I think those books are tremendous. I don't know if you've read them.
No, I actually haven't. But everything you're saying is what I've heard. It's, you know, fantastic and well structured, and the, you know, the vision to carry that narrative across six, seven books is—it's dense, to say the least.
Dense and remarkably, amazingly good writing. And I know it's really hard for George now to get those last two books out because there are all these new pressures on him.
Yeah.
I think they paid him a huge amount of money to come up with a different book that they could base the series on. You know, so. It becomes very, very difficult. I think it was easier back when the only medium was books.
Mm-hmm. I can't argue with that. You know,
I guess there are books and stage plays and operas.
Mm-hmm.
But once other technologies afforded other mediums, then you know, well, it's like herding stray cats.
Is there a longer cut of the film that exists? Is there, you know, things that were really drastically changed after a certain point? Were there any? Because I mean, for something to be so focused, I mean, there's got to be a lot of things that maybe things that didn't work or things you tried or, you know, maybe, you know, what in the creative process really got, you know, lost or jettisoned along the way to get to such the, you know, this amazing benchmark that we all love?
Well, once they started shooting, I'd have to say no. It was a good 4 or 5 years in development. And I think the structure changed quite a bit in that. Well, for example, Switch, not changing gender going into the Matrix, things like that.
Okay.
Changed. But once they shot it, as far as I'm aware, no full scenes were cut out. I know there was one sequence that got eliminated. When Morpheus and Neo went to the Oracle for the first time, I guess the only time in the Matrix, but I never saw this footage, but apparently as Neo started to open the door, he and Morpheus got in this long philosophical discussion, and then they went into the Oracle's house or apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it was awful.
Really?
Yeah, Keanu and Larry started improvising.
Oh, really?
But so that didn't make it. But nothing of substance. And it's kind of amazing because the set pieces, the Wachowskis kind of were sort of proud of themselves that could make really long set pieces, and the fight in the subway goes on for a long time and mm-hmm. doesn't lose energy. And then there's a chase sequence after that.
Yes.
Which is, you know, when you're looking at it and you're going to score, it's like, oh my God. But none of that stuff got waylaid.
Okay.
I mean, it would shorten somewhat as the editor worked, and sometimes it would lengthen as the visual effects shots came in.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say that anything substantial got on the floor in any of the three movies, actually. So there's no like director's cut. They got pretty much what they wanted.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, to get what they needed out of you, did you get everything that you needed? What did you have a truncated timeline? You know, did you have a rushed scoring job? Because I believe you read the script while you were doing Bound, if I'm not mistaken. So when did you kind of come on board?
No, it was after Bound, but it was a good couple of years. Good year or so before they started shooting, I read the script and saw their storyboards and you know, their conceptual art.
I see.
So I know that they were working on it. Supposedly, when they did Bound, they had approached Warner Brothers with The Matrix, and they said, "You know, this is good. Shoot a movie, and we'll talk." So they went out. No, well, that's pretty normal, really.
Okay.
So they went out and did Bound, and they wrote Bound and put it on the market, and they were working for Dino De Laurentiis at the time. And Dino turned it down, they put it on the market and got 4 offers immediately, and then Dino said, "I'm doing this." So there was a trajectory that they were on.
I gotcha.
No question about that. But I wasn't aware of Matrix while we were doing Bound, and I didn't read the script until we were finished.
Okay.
Well after we were finished.
You mentioned earlier the idea of, or that sequence at the end where the subway goes to the alleyway, goes to the heart of the city motel, and then you also have the sentinels attacking the Nebuchadnezzar. So when you have two different action sequences happening at the same time, what's your approach to that?
Well, you have to deal with them separately. I mean, you have to you have to accompany the visual at the time. So when Neo was being chased, you know, there was music for him running. Then when they cut to the sentinels coming, you had to play that. So I was hitting things probably maybe more than I would have liked, but they definitely liked things like music to hit things on the screen.
Okay.
Like, for example, the footsteps. They wanted that.
Okay.
They wanted the
pile driver
on the footsteps.
Okay.
And then later when Neo comes back to life and then they start shooting at him and he puts up his hands and the bullets stop.
Mm-hmm.
Then he picks one and looks at it and then drops it. They wanted, when it hit the ground, bang, bang, you know.
Oh, really?
They were specific about that. You know, that's not something I would have done without being directed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, yeah, when he's running, you got to play running. When the sentinels are there, you got to play the sentinels. So so I was going back and forth quite a bit.
And, I imagine you probably work on the same palette you have. You don't just bring a marxophone into it just because it's a different scene. It's got to blend, but still be distinctive enough. Because, if you think of Return of the Jedi, there's three action sequences happening. So the idea of weaving back and forth between those, I got kind of the same feeling at the end of The Matrix, that it's...
Yeah. Well, bringing in a marxophone isn't going to change anything. you've got to play what's on the screen, and certainly Williams in all the Star Wars movies and most of his action stuff would get pretty specific to what's going on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the old school way of doing it. Don't do it so much anymore, but never quite know what the wind will blow in, do you?
No, you just gotta deal with it. Like my dad says, 90% of success is just showing up, right?
Well, let's see. Or Churchill said, success is just going from failure to failure without a drop in enthusiasm.
I've actually never heard that. That's a great one. That's really...
I like that one.
What was the mindset of music in the 90s? You have something like Fight Club, which was done by the Dust Brothers, which was very, very electronic. And, you know, you've got a movie like The Matrix half existing in a, computer-controlled world. Were there talks about doing this not orchestrally? Were there, what was the kind of competition in the mindset of the 90s that maybe factored in?
Well, I don't know if I can answer the mindset of the 90s, because things were in flux. They were changing pretty fast then, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But they never said they wanted a synthesizer score. They said they wanted orchestra. And there were synthesizer elements to it. But when they wanted an electronica kind of thing, they went with a needle drop song, you know, which played fairly heavily in the film. So I think they got their... That's where they looked to get the idea of a synthesizer for an electronic world from that.
Mm-hmm.
And let the orchestra play the rest of it. But I didn't have to fight anybody to try to get an orchestra on there. They wanted... In fact, they wanted a choir, and that wasn't my idea. So it's kind of interesting because I don't know if we should put this in the Hollywood Reporter, but I'll tell you because we're friends.
Yes, Mr. Davis, we are.
It was a non-SAG movie. They shot it in Sydney, Australia, and the, I think, five or six SAG actors got waivers to do it. So we came back here, and you know they wanted a choir, but choirs in Hollywood are under the SAG contract. So Warner Brothers attorneys told me in no uncertain terms they are not interested in signing a SAG agreement for this movie.
Hmm.
So I ended up going to Salt Lake City and doing the choir with members or former members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to overdub the choir stuff. Which, I thought that was interesting.
No, that is. That is. So how did... So the actors got waivers, but WB said we're not going to extend the contract to Sydney?
To singers.
To singers. Okay. Interesting. Yeah,
because singers are SAG.
Okay.
Screen Actors Guild. I think that comes from the tradition of, you know, Broadway show singing.
Oh, okay. So they're more performers than just a visual, a vocal box. I gotcha.
Well, somehow it fell under that aegis.
Okay. Well, is there, you know, so... Go ahead.
It's kind of unfortunate because their rule, you know, SAG's a pretty powerful union, and, you know, their rules are pretty tough. In other words, if you needed one singer for a two-minute cue, you had to hire him or her for a full day.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, stuff like that. Very tough. And so, and it made it prohibitive a lot of times to use choir in film scores, and difficult as well to release the soundtrack because they all had to be paid again.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that's that.
Okay. Well, speaking about how the choir is its own instrument and the individuals in the choir are technically instruments, are there things that certain instruments or certain motifs represent anything to you? You know, were there any sort of hints or nods that you specifically said, I want this in there because it means this? Did you go that deep when you were working on this?
No, I mean, I don't really think of instruments as something that represents something else.
Okay.
Other than their physical properties. In other words, brass is loud and percussion is slamming and strings are linear, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, a clarinet solo doesn't indicate to me anything different than, you know, doesn't indicate, well, this character came in or something, you know.
Okay.
That's not the way I think of music.
Okay. I only asked that because I was listening to an interview you had and you said that the choir actually represents the humanity overcome by the machines, and I just wasn't sure if there was anything similar to that in
I did say that, and you know, not to contradict myself, I think a choir can do that because, you know, it's people's actual instruments is in their body, and that I could make that distinction, but that isn't necessarily what a choir would represent. But I think in The Matrix it kind of did.
Okay.
You know, when the choir showed up, it was, particularly in the sequence where you saw the battery fields, or I forget what they called them, you know, the big tower where Neo came out of his little pod, that was kind of, you know, I think they were looking to represent humanitarian crises like the Holocaust.
Yeah, okay.
And as such, the choir sort of made sense in there.
Okay.
So, yeah, I did say that, and I still, I reiterate that. But it was their idea. I didn't come and say, hey, we got to have a choir.
I gotcha. Well, don't worry.
When they said choir, I didn't say, nah. You know, I said, oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. You know, I talked to Harry Gregson-Williams about the work he did on Ridley Scott's The Martian, and he said that there's a part towards the end where the choir comes in, and he wanted the choir to kind of, you know, Watney is all alone on Mars, and he said by including the choir, he was trying to, you know, represent the good feelings of the entire human race trying to bring Watney back. And I thought, man, that's deep stuff. But anyway.
Yeah, deep. Actually, I did a movie, Behind Enemy Lines, and the director wanted a choir in that. And I thought it worked pretty good in sequences where he was representing the Bosnian genocide. But when it came out, I think it was Hollywood Reporter, you know, and said, you know, this movie, he didn't like the movie. And then he said, and the music, they use a choir. A choir! Okay. Got it.
Keep away from them. Like in that movie, the new Wreck-It Ralph movie, there's a part where they kind of say, well, yeah, stay out of the comments if you don't want to, you know, there's just trolls out there. So, you know.
Yeah, but who can resist?
You know, Morpheus asks Neo in the movie, do you believe in fate? You know, here we are 20 years later. This is still on people's minds. Do you, Don Davis, do you believe in fate? What side of the fate coin do you fall on?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question. What is fate, you'd have to ask. Fate is ultimately what happens, right? So ultimately something happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, unless you're a theoretical physicist and believe in string theory, in which there are multiple universes and realities, there's really only one way things turn out, which is, I suppose, that's fate.
Yeah.
If you think of things in terms of string theory and alternate universes and all the different possible universes, you know, when you think of something like, say, Cuban Missile Crisis, we came very close to a nuclear holocaust. And perhaps in another sequence, that actually happened. But it didn't happen in this one because we're still here.
Mm-hmm. You see. Yeah, that makes sense.
So do I, not really, but do I believe in fate? I can't. That depends on how you define fate.
Okay. Well, I wasn't trying to, you know, get a soundbite or something. Ever since I saw the movie, I've thought about certain scenes in the movie. You know, and one of them is that where Neo goes, no, because I don't like the idea. I don't have control over myself. And I always thought, you know, that always stuck with me, as did other parts of the movie, like when he knocks over the vase and she goes, and don't worry about the vase. And he turns around, and he goes, sorry. She goes, I said, don't worry about it. And then the real zinger is the part he's like, where she goes, now here's the part that's going to bake your noodle. Would you still have broken it if I hadn't have said anything? And I just think of, oh, man, that's just heady stuff.
Well, the thing that I really got me excited when I read the script was the philosophical aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you could make a popular movie based on, you know, Plato and those kinds of philosophers, and Descartes in particular. Even though, I mean, one critic came out and said, well, it's not exactly Plato, is it? And where he said, oh, now we have to be Plato, right? But the thing is, it was a mainstream movie in which they made as much of a fictionalized narrative of philosophy as Jean-Paul Sartre did in No Exit and the and his four novels, you know, and that was really intriguing to me, and that's why I was so interested in, and you know, that they would have a discussion, or basically the whole idea of the Matrix was a takeoff on Plato's Cave.
Gotcha.
So, you know, the fact that they were referencing this stuff, even if ultimately it was somewhat superficial, and it would have to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not going to sit down and read Sartre's Being and Nothingness and make a movie out of it. I think that it raised the consciousness of enough people to be aware of philosophical thought and idea that made it a significant thing. And I'm proud to be a part of that.
And I share your elation. I think that you're exactly right. Because it did. I mean, I can't think of a single person I've talked to who, one, doesn't love The Matrix, and then, two, says, oh my gosh, I learned so much, I thought about this. And even to the point where they had philosophers and people do commentary tracks. And I've heard people say, man, if you really want to get in The Matrix, listen to that one commentary track. And I go, and I do, and it's amazing how much there is. Well,
what Cornel West said, yeah, that was very interesting.
Well, let me ask you one more question. So the idea of going back and listening to your work, you know, when I talked to Henry Jackman, I said, do you go back? And he goes, I almost never listen to my work because I feel like I'll pick it apart. When you're doing the concert pieces, is there an opportunity to expand on a theme, to maybe fix a couple notes that, you know, you thought were could be improved upon when you were scoring this? You know, what do the concerts give you now that you have control over it?
Well, one thing that we did was in the original movie, at the end, they use a song from Rage Against the Machine. And when we were scoring it, they hadn't gotten the rights to that yet, so they asked me to cover it, which I did. And then when they got the rights, they used the song. So, for the concert thing, it seemed appropriate, you know, since it was an orchestral concert, to end the movie with the original orchestral thing that I had written for that sequence.
Okay.
Rather than use the song. So that's kind of cool. But in terms of, you know, changing this or that just to change it or something, I haven't done that.
Okay.
But I do, you know, you say you do revisit it. Yeah, we have to go and rehearse it. So I do revisit it. And I'm pretty happy with it. I mean, there's things I would do differently now, I suppose, if I were to redo it or to do it again.
Gotcha.
But I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I think I stuck around to the very last three seconds of the film when I was listening to your audio commentary track, and you said, to all the people who are still sticking around, thank you. This has been one of the best experiences I've ever worked on. I know I'm paraphrasing it, but you just threw out that little zinger at the end. So it seems like you still feel that way about it, but where on maybe the totem pole of your career, where do you think Matrix sits?
Well, it's at the top. I mean, that was certainly a turning point in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I had the freedom to do the, like I said, that postmodern idea I had the freedom to do that. And I can't think of another movie in which I would have had that freedom, in which it would work as well with the narrative. And so, that's on the top for me.
Excellent. You know, I was in, I have a daughter who's 3, and we were watching Toy Story the other day, and actually, this was about 6 months ago, and I saw your name in the credits, and, you know, to what you said about Randy Newman doing fantastic string work, what was it like working with Randy, and if you had to choose one or the other, would you prefer composing or orchestrating?
Well, I prefer composing, because, you know, because then you're the man. But it's great fun working with Randy.
Uh-huh.
I've known a lot of really smart people, but I haven't known a lot of brilliant people, and Randy's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He's also one of the best people, truly generous people, mm-hmm. And honest. You know, which is really rare in this business, especially rare in the record business in which he has resided.
Yeah, he's an icon.
Well, I think he's the best songwriter in the world, bar none. And the thing that's interesting about him is that he's a real composer, not just a songwriter, and which is a tradition that goes back to Gershwin. You know, in the early 20th century, there were songwriters like Gershwin and Richard Rodgers, Vernon Duke, and Meredith Willson, who were real composers but also wrote songs. The difference with Randy, though, is that he also writes the lyrics. The only one of those composer-songwriters who wrote lyrics was Meredith Willson. And his lyrics were good, but I don't think you can put him in the same category as Randy Newman. I think Randy Newman's lyrics are on a par with Johnny Hart. And his music, he's certainly the heir to Gershwin and Richard Rodgers and Alfred Newman. He has impeccable musicianship. And he's the real thing. He's the rare real thing.
Well, you know, I'm happy to be speaking with you, and out of the three, I love The Matrix Reloaded. I think the cues in that are so dense and so varied and impactful. And I have to ask, after the success of the first one, did you just get carte blanche to just hit it as hard as you could? You know, how did you go from The Matrix to Reloaded? And what manifested things like the Burly Brawl and working with Juno Reactor? And I mean, this could be a whole nother conversation, but I just want to get some, you know, some ideas.
No, that all came from them.
Okay.
So, I was not given carte blanche, no.
Okay.
As their heads exploded, they, you know, took more control over things that they knocked out Reloaded and Revolutions in about 6 months.
Hmm.
So it's not going to have the same depth. It just can't.
I gotcha.
But
it took 3 or 4 years to do, right?
Sorry?
I said, but it took 3.5, 4 years to film everything, didn't it?
No. Do you mean Matrix or the sequels?
Oh, the two sequels.
Maybe 2 years. They shot them both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were in Sydney for about a year shooting. And then they came back. So it wasn't 3 years by any stretch.
Okay.
And, you know, they were under a lot of pressure to get that done. And, you know, there's a lot more money, a lot more a lot more riding on everything. So, and that happens generally with any successful movie that spawns sequels. That the, you know, let's say the Rocky movies, for example. Mm-hmm. First one was a low budget, independent film, you know, that came in under the radar, and then Rocky II came out, and it was like hundreds of millions of dollars, and everybody breathing down everybody's neck. So, you know, it's not going to be the same. But that's not to say that the Wachowskis didn't make the statement they wanted to make in those two movies.
Mm-hmm.
But the pressure was way more intense. So they also were contending with, you know, there were negative reviews to The Matrix too, and that affected them. You know, it didn't affect them if they changed anything they were going to do, but it affected them like, oh God, what are they going to say about us now? You know?
Yeah, I get you.
But as far as my freedom went, no, they were much more micromanaging in the sequels than in the first one.
Okay.
That's not to limit their micromanaging in the first one, but they...
now it's intensified.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, let's take a step back now to maybe finish this up. So the idea of you doing the concert pieces, are there things that you notice that, you know, are there things that you have liked in the film that have maybe gotten better by multiple viewings? Are there things that you, you know, are still picking up on? Do you have a favorite cue in a character? You know, like, let's talk about maybe the fun stuff. What do you enjoy about doing these concert pieces?
Well, I mean, I have favorite scenes more than favorite character or something. I mean, like the scene with the, you know, the guy at the door, you know, always tickles me.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene with when we first meet Agent Smith. When Agent Smith is with Neo in the interrogation room.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, we've had our eyes on you for some time now, Mr. Anderson. You know, that's just such a great
mm-hmm.
moment. So it's really enjoyable to see how well the movie holds together, and it's held its own over the years. It's somebody pointed out to me that. You know, you have all the things with these antiquated looking cell phones,
mm-hmm.
is the Nokias and stuff. And that's kind of justified when Morpheus says, you think it's 1999, but in reality, it's 2000 and whatever.
Or 2199.
And that kind of justifies the fact that the technology is stuck in 1999, but that's part of the narrative.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant.
Things like that, I think that was more accidental than brilliant. Things like that, you know, worked in its favor. I think also it's just one of those things that, you know, like when I read the script and saw the philosophical stuff. I was really excited, and I think everybody else was too. So I know that everybody put in their, you know, 200%, and that's what made it really happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Wachowskis had put so much time and effort into the thought process of writing the scripts, and they had really solid ideas about how they wanted to shoot it, and that was inspiring to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a vision, and they stuck to it, and that's rare, and it's really a great thing to be part of.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.